Hello, I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinkyou.com, coming to you with the Floydcast number 9 for April 14. I've got a nice little to-do list for these Floydcasts now. I've got a few subjects I want to bring to you in the future. And I thought today I'd take a step to the side and just provide a bit of perspective of why I do these casts, where I'm going, and to talk about a bit of sports. Many of you are probably thinking you're glad that I haven't focused too much on sports. Sports is one of those things that can really be dominant. You know, this is April, so we just came through March Madness. March Madness being the NCAA basketball tournaments for men and women, or young men and young women. This year, famously, the brackets, you know, you pick your winners. And I guess there's 64 teams, but this year there's even some more, or there's talk of some adding some more, who have to sort of qualify to get into the 64. And then the 64, you know, they play each other, then you have 32, then 16, then 8, then 4, then 2, and then finally a winner. It's a good thing. Everyone, you know, has to win to continue. But of course, one bad game and an otherwise great team is kicked out. That's why in some tournaments, like in soccer, they have a round robin. This year, there's going to be the World Cup. And I got to say, I'm really looking forward to the World Cup soccer. North America, not really a soccer place. It's become a bit more so in high school, and I guess maybe in college, I'm assuming. Soccer has taken hold a little bit. Interesting that a lot of women play soccer, a lot of girls and a lot of women play soccer now. A very healthy sport, low contact. You know, you run around like mad, right? And that's good in a sport. I played when I was younger. My father's English, from England, came over, I guess what would be 60 years ago now. And so he grew up with soccer. My dad grew up really poor. More poor than we can imagine, and maybe that's a good thing that we can't imagine it. So for him, soccer wasn't, you know, a soccer ball and fancy boots and all that. Soccer was kicking something around that only you and the other kids would call a soccer ball. Probably didn't have a proper field. You weren't allowed on the proper field. There weren't enough of them. Yeah, so you played in the street or, you know, a deserted field or something. So anyway, later this year, looking forward to the World Cup. You're going to be hearing from me on that subject. My father figured out what was wrong with soccer. And I have been meaning to do an article on it. Let me just make a note. Maybe as the World Cup progresses, I'll talk a little bit about my dad's philosophy of soccer. You know, it comes right back to life itself. In other words, soccer is reflecting how sort of mixed up we are. It's interesting that in Top Gear, the British TV show Top Gear, which is about cars, for those who don't know, Jeremy Clarkson, the host, who's really a magnificent host, he really grows on you. He's really the man for the job. Anyway, he often jokes about footballers and how a certain car will be, you know, the only people that are going to be buying it are footballers. With one car, he famously, as he was driving this car at a truly breakneck speed, and I've never heard him so vocal or so funny, as he was bombing along, he was saying, when this car, I don't even remember that a car exactly, when this car comes out, he said, there won't be a ditch in all of England that isn't full of soccer players having ditched this car, because it was a little bit unruly. That's a good line. So, soccer and life today. We'll talk about it in the future. What else? Well, I guess we're coming into the summer, and so you get a bit more of some of the sports, sort of the infrequent sports come up. Like last week I caught a bit of cricket, and that was kind of awesome. I think it was last weekend, but I don't think I podcasted about it, and now I don't remember. Cricket is another sport that not played almost at all in North America. Some parts of the world, they go nuts for it. It's the sport. Like in India. I believe that cricket is the sport in India. It's easy to make fun of cricket. Maybe I'll talk more about that in the future when I get a chance. Let me make a note. What other sports? Well, we had our Winter Olympics this year, so it will be 2 years before the Summer Olympics, so no Olympics to talk about. You know, Olympics, I always like it just for the, you know, the limits. And for that matter, I like Top Gear for the limits. You know, they get cars that are $3 million and drive them through 3-foot-deep water in Dubai or wherever it was, or drive them on their epic journeys. There's something about doing things, you know, I was going to say to an extreme. I think just extreme by itself is not necessarily, it's not sustainable, right? For example, there are extreme, parachutists, who we now call base jumpers. They jump off a building with a parachute, and their only hope of living is that the parachute works perfectly, and they let it go at the right time, and it doesn't get tangled, and they don't, hit some high tension wires. It's funny how we call them high tension wires, but they're power wires, right? They're dangerous in the power. It's not in the tension. The tension doesn't do anything to you. High tension lines. High tension power lines. We always sort of simplify to the point where we lose the meaning. So base jumping is a little too extreme. Base jumping is truly and always will be an extreme sport. There is no guarantee in base jumping. And sadly, for quite a share of the population, they don't care. They lust for a thrill so much that they will sacrifice safety to that extent. I think some... You can hear the dog shifting in the background. That's Elka. Sweet Elka. She just let out a big sigh. She knows nothing much is going to happen for the next hour or two. It's just before 5 in the morning. Things are nice and calm. But, you have to thread the balance in life and with sports. You have to thread the balance. For myself, I grew up with sports. It was part of being a kid and it was part of playing. But also my dad liked certain sports. My dad loved soccer. Played it. Played it well. Interesting about soccer. We loved football. My dad and I watched football. We played football. I played with my friends. Tennis. We loved watching tennis. We followed all the great tennis players. Back in the Rosewall and Newcomb and Emerson and Ocker, Tom Ocker days. All the way through to the present. But now steroids are, clearly becoming a factor in tennis. It's too bad. One of the sports my dad did not like baseball. Kind of sympathizer, I understand. I think, you either like cricket or you like baseball kind of thing. And for myself, I like both. I don't watch much baseball because I think normally baseball is a little boring. It's a little bit too formulaic. There's limited things that can happen at any moment. If there's one guy on base, then you have a strategy. If there's a guy in first and a guy in second, then you have a different strategy. And it's a little formulaic. But when you get to like the World Series, when you get to the top end of any sport, it becomes really exceptional. And so, taking in some of the World Series is always worth it. Cricket, you could certainly say cricket is boring. If you actually try and go and watch some cricket, you will not make it to the end. I've done it. I've watched cricket in Vancouver, Canada. I have a beautiful cricket pitch in Stanley Park. One of the greatest pitches, I would bet, in the world. Maybe the greatest in the world. Beautiful. Couldn't be more scenic. But you go there and you take in a bit. I would ride my bike, which was the main activity. I was getting exercise. I would just plop myself down on the grass, and I had nothing. I didn't have water. I didn't have food. I didn't have a backpack. It was just the summer and a bike ride, riding your bike. And you cricket, it's flat. Like a soccer pitch, a cricket pitch is flat. But like in, say, football, for example, you have stands. You climb up in the bleachers. You rarely see football that doesn't have bleachers. Why is that? Well, football, there's a huge investment. Each team is 30, 40, 50 players. Think of how many coaches there are. Think of how many parents had to buy pads for their child and boots, and all that stuff. And there's a band, right? Football is this massive enterprise. It's two armies. Clash of Titans. And Remember the Titans is one of the names of one of the football movies. So football tends towards the epic. Soccer tends towards the more simple. And cricket, again, very simple. What do you need for cricket?
Oh, I'm back.
I had to make some notes there. I'm going to have trouble remembering where I was. Apologies. I think I was talking about cricket. How you can make the case that cricket is boring. I think cricket is more a nice activity for those that do it. Not a big following kind of an activity. Something you take in part of. One of the problems with cricket, or one of the good things with cricket, depending how you look at it, is that it can go on a long period of time. It's not as well defined. Like baseball, three outs. Three up, three down, end of an inning. Baseball, you can sort of predict it'll be between this length of time and this length of time. The shortest game is 2 hours, and the longest game is, 4 hours or whatever. The one thing with baseball is it keeps going until somebody wins. And that's the one thing that makes baseball potentially last a long time. Cricket is done by outs, but it's done by 10 outs. You have 11 people, and you need two batters at all times. And so when the 10th person goes out, then the 11th person can no longer bat because they're by themselves. So then it's over. So that's one way. That's the international test match way, where they play for 5 days. Each team plays for 2.5 days. I don't know how the exact breakdown between the two teams and the 5 days works out, but these test matches last 5 days. That's one game. But it's based on you try not to go out. And with cricket, one of the ways that you don't go out as readily is you don't have to run. If you hit the ball and you think, oh, I am not able to run, I can't complete the run safely, you can just choose not to run. And you're defending your wickets. So you're trying to stop the ball from going through the strike zone, if you will. In baseball, you have a strike zone. It's imaginary. The umpire decides. In cricket, you have a strike zone, which is the wickets behind you. If the ball hits the wickets, it's hit the strike zone and you are out. When you run, the fielders try and field the ball to the wickets. They can throw the ball to the wicket. So that's unusual. You can go out by someone throwing the ball at the wickets. In baseball, you have to be tagged out. There can be a force out. There's no force out in cricket. You either hit the wickets before the runner is safe, or you don't. Or you can catch the ball, I guess. There's that kind of an out, which is the same as baseball. So there's some similarities, some differences. It's an interesting game. It was on recently, anyway. There was an international match. It was between India and Sri Lanka, I believe. And India won, I believe. But it was nice to watch, and nice to watch it on ESPN. It surprised me. It just came out of the blue. Caught a bit of it. And it was a nice little treat that day. So that's a bit how I am with sports. Is, you know, it's other than football. Football, I'm a little bit more fanatical, I'll admit it. But not really fanatical. More, I think it's more deeply in my veins. And it's even more compelling. Some things are sort of momentary hotspots. It's like we're on a website and we momentarily find something interesting and then we're gone. We don't even remember the site after we left. And other sites, you know, we go back to frequently. Football is a site I go back to frequently. I should talk more about football in the future. It's a wonderful game. I just love it. And yeah, it's too bad that you can get hurt. It's a dangerous game. But yeah, there are ways to play it where it's not so as well. So, golf. There is a sport this weekend or this week. You know, golf is played, the formula of golf is it's played Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 4 days. Thursday and Friday are the qualifying days, and the people that qualify play on the weekend, Saturday, Sunday. So it's a good formula. You never know who's going to be good. In a way, it's a bit like round robin of soccer, where everyone plays everybody else, and so you sort of decide who's playing well, and those are the ones that advance. In golf, you get a full chance, 2 18 whole days of play to find out who's playing well, and those are the ones that go to the weekend. That's a very deserving system. There are some exceptions. There are sponsors' exemptions for some of the lesser tournaments. A sponsor can go, I want, you know, Bob to play. And Bob can be maybe not a very good golfer or not as good at the moment, but he qualifies to play because the sponsor decided. And sometimes, for example, John Daly is a good example. John Daly was kind of burst onto the scene. I think he was an alternate. I think he played either the U.S. Open. I think it was the U.S. Open. So a very prestigious tournament, he was an alternate. He was a guy that initially didn't quite qualify, and then someone else, you know, something happened, and then next thing you know, John Daly's in the tournament. And he went on to win. Well, nothing can be more earth-shattering than for an unknown to come along and then just suddenly win in golf. That's, you know, Tiger was not an unknown. I remember seeing Tiger at like age 4 or whatever, 2 or whatever it was, some super young age on, I think it was Merv Griffin. And there was Tiger swinging a club. So Tiger has been a phenomenon from the get-go. But occasionally someone comes with very little fanfare, very little build-up, and they're just suddenly an item. Suddenly they're great. John Daly was like that. And unfortunately, you know, emotionally, John Daly has always lacked the stability. You know, golf is a very stable game. You need to be a stable individual. When you play for 5 hours. That's a long time. You need to be in relatively good shape to play for 5 hours. Now, part of it is if you play golf every day, well, then you'll be able to play golf tomorrow. You know, your body becomes used to it. In other words, you know, golf is mostly healthy, right? You're walking. You walk, you know, for 5 hours or 4 hours and 4.5 hours, and then you swing a club. 70 or 80 times, which takes about half an hour. So golf is 90% walking. I mean, if someone wants to make a claim about a boring sport, you could make that claim about golf. But what stops golf on TV from being so boring is the television coverage. I remember once someone just making sort of a somewhat incidental comment saying that golf was one of the toughest sports to cover. Think about it. You can have players on all 18 holes at once. Some holes are a third of a mile long, so the guy can be anywhere in that third of a mile. So imagine a third of a mile times 18. You know, it's not quite that because some holes are a lot shorter, but, you know, golf courses are like 5 miles long. You need 5 miles of coverage. You know, Formula One racing, the course is not 5 miles long. It's like about 3 miles long. And, you know, you're in a long straightaway in Formula One, you only need a couple of cameras. You know, one at each end looking at the straight, maybe one in the middle, fancy one in the middle. That's about it. And that gets you, you know, almost a mile of coverage type thing. But golf, and then when you get great golfers, when you get a Tiger Woods or, you know, someone, what do they call it, the featured twosome, the featured pairing, or, you know, they'll have an extra camera crew that just follows that pairing. And then in the really great tournaments, they'll have maybe an extra camera crew for every pairing. Well, this weekend is like that. This weekend is the Masters. And it's one of the four majors in golf. And you have to win to get to this tournament. So some tournaments, you know, you just qualify. Thursday and Friday, you play well, and they're like, oh, you're playing better than everybody else, you're in. Masters, no. You're not invited to the Masters unless you have won in the last year, or there are certain exemptions. These days, you know, the exemption process is a little more involved, but well thought out. What they do is golf has four majors, and there's like a fifth, almost a major tournament. And if you win one of those major tournaments, then you will get exemptions for the other major tournaments for like 5 years or 10 years, depending. So what that says is, if you're in the majors, everyone wants to win a major so much. Everyone tries so much harder to win a major. If you win a major, it says you weren't just good, you were exceptional. And so it makes the reasonable assumption that people want to watch you more. You've got something special. And, you know, you can do it again. You know, the great ones can do it again. Look at Tiger, 17 majors. So you can get to the Masters if you have won another tournament in the last year, or if you won a major tournament within the last so many years, and I don't know the details, but let's say in the previous 5 years, if you won any other major tournament. There's the U.S. Open, the British Open, the PGA, and the Masters. Those are the four great tournaments. And the Opens mean anyone can play if you qualify. So on one end of the spectrum, you have the U.S. Open and the British Open, where it's based on, do you qualify at the moment? I, in theory, could play in the U.S. Open or the British Open. All I'd have to do is play locally and win. And then I'd have to play at the next level and win. And by about the third round, I've qualified for the U.S. Open, in theory. In reality, I am one of the worst golfers on the planet. I think I'm holding the wrong end of the club. I think it's probably something as simple as that. You're not supposed to grab onto the metal part? Yeah, see, I didn't know that. I've probably been doing that wrong all this time. I kind of amaze myself how bad I am, because I'm a pretty determined person, and I think about stuff a lot over long periods of time. That has made no difference to my golf game. But someone who was really great was my dad, and he had such a natural way of playing golf. It was really a delight to watch him play, because he almost never played. When I say almost never, I think I saw him play twice or three times, and those were the only times he had played, you know, in the previous 10 or 20 years or whatever it was. So he plays almost never, but when he plays, the smoothness and naturalness of his swing is, well, I'm envious, because he just couldn't help but hit the ball well. He almost never hit it, you know, fat or sliced or faded it or whatever the various words are. He just wound up. He would just use a 9-iron. This is on, you know, pitch and putt courses, the shorter courses. And typically in those courses, you know, you take a 7-iron, a 9-iron, and a putter. 7-iron for the longer holes. Well, my dad would just hit the 9-iron on the longer holes. In other words, he was long. He could hit the 9-iron a long way, and of course, sky high, just unimaginably high in the air. beautiful arcs, and away you'd go. And I would be all over, to the left, to the right, in the water. One time in the Little Pigeon Putt, I managed to hit it completely off the course and into someone's property. It's not easy. I think that hole that I did that on was about 80 yards long. Like, that is a stone's throw, almost literally. And yet I hit it about 40 yards off course. That's a 45 degree angle off course. And yet sometimes I've hit it 90 degrees off. I went to a driving range, and I, instead of hitting the ball out, you know, in front of yourself, I've hit the ball directly vertically to the point of hitting the roof, the covering of the driving range. I don't think that happens very often. And I've done it more than once. It will always be a constant source of entertainment how bad I am at golf. And that's probably why I appreciate, you know, the great golfers so much. It seems that the human is suited to golf in the sense that, or the human desire to dial it in, to get better and better. I remember at that same driving range, I've only gone once, and I was the guy freaking out the good golfers at the range. They were like, who the heck is this guy? You would not believe what he just did. But these guys, they were like, if you remember the old pitching machines, you know, they were contraptions. They were cool contraptions of my youth. You know, it would load the balls in, and then it had sort of this spring-loaded arm, and it would fling the ball at the pitcher so that a machine could pitch to you and you could hit a whole bunch of baseballs. Well, it's repeatable, right? You get that pitching machine lined up and it keeps throwing the ball in pretty much the same spot. Well, golfers are like this. I remember watching one guy in the range. He would wind up his swing and then he would just stop it. He would have his swing, you know, wound up, and then he'd maybe start to swing through, but he'd only swing like, let's say, a foot, and then he would stop and he would look at his whole body. He's not looking at somebody else's body. He's looking at his own body. And then he would swing like another maybe foot, and he'd be watching himself through that foot. The precision of what he was doing. And then sure enough, when he would hit it, it was exactly like the pitch machine. Out the ball would go 250 yards. You know, that used to be the range, right? The great golfers, you know, they used to hit it like 250 yards, maybe 220. And, you know, they still do. The Nicklauses or that era, the Gary players, you know, that's how far they hit it. But two things happened. One is the golf clubs got better. The woods, in quote, you know, became, well, they were woods originally, but they became woods in name only. They became metal. And now you hear the ping of a golf ball instead of the thwack. So the golf balls, the golf clubs, you know, they helped you with increase your yardage. But the players became stronger. Golf didn't used to be a sport in the usual sense. It used to be, a gentleman's game. Tiger was one of the ones to change that. Well, actually, Gary Player, let's give credit. Gary Player, a relatively unknown golfer here, partly because he was born on the other side of the world, South Africa. But Gary Player is one of the first to take training seriously. And that guy still, he's, I think, heading towards 80, certainly in his 70s. And he's probably in better shape than I am, and he's probably in better shape than most people in his 70s. And, you know, you would say, well, it's because he's still playing. Well, he doesn't have to play. This guy's worth probably tens of millions of dollars. When you're at the level of Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, you get invited to places. And people throw money at you. Please come to our tournament. We will pay you money. But Gary Player still takes being in shape seriously. So he was revolutionary. Well, Tiger took it to the next level. You know, it's interesting, when Tiger broke on the scene, Phil Mickelson's a little bit older than Tiger. And Phil Mickelson is in the old school, the not-in-shape school. Just his physique. Phil Mickelson does not have a sportsman's physique. In fairness, he probably is, you know, quite athletic and strong, deceptively so, but you don't have to be in golf. John Daly is, despite being very long, hitting it very long, is not athletic. But Tiger was and is. Tiger was the one to go to the weight room. Him and his caddy, Steve, at the time. Steve Williams, they would go to the weight room and they would train seriously with weights. And so Tiger became this longer hitter. And Tiger, you know, routinely would hit the ball 300 yards instead of, you know, 225, let's say. And the Tiger length phenomena, distance phenomena, was such that they ended up changing golf courses just to deal with Tiger Woods. Because if you had a course that went out and turned left, they call that a dog leg left, or went out and turned right, a dog leg right. Well, in some cases, Tiger Woods would hit it right over the corner. So instead of Tiger having to take two shots to go around that dog leg and get to the green, he would hit it right over the top, and sometimes right onto the green. This was kind of revolutionary when it happened. And, you know, golf courses, there's a huge investment, millions of dollars to make it. And if suddenly someone can, you know, bypass your dog leg permanently, and you're like, well, what the heck here? Like, someone ran out of bounds. It's interesting in football. In football, you have possession of the ball, and if you don't maintain possession through meeting the requirements, you might say, then you have to give the ball to the other team. So when you kick the ball to the other team, you want that other team to not make progress. So you want to stop them right away. So things have evolved over the years that now when you kick the ball, you have very fast players on what they call the special team, the team that's involved in kicking the ball to the other team or receiving it. You have special players there, speed players. And in particular, you have a couple of guys that you call runners. And, I mean, these are supreme top athletes who their goal is to run down the field very fast. Now imagine, when you kick a ball in football, you kick it about 60 yards. That's in the air, 60 yards. To give you an idea, a kid's field, like at a school, the kid's field is probably 60 yards long. I know at our kid's school, their K-5 school, their elementary school, that's about the length of the field. Well, that means that a top football kicker can kick it from one end of the field in the air to the other. That's a football. Now, you can do that with a soccer ball because a soccer ball has more of the trajectory of a golf ball. For some reason, you can kick a ball, soccer ball, a little bit easier than a football. Partly because of the weird shape, but just partly the aerodynamic limitations of a football. I speak from experience. I've done some punting, and I kind of like punting. I've done all the things in football, but I surprised myself by becoming quite good at punting. Anyway, so when you kick it to 60 yards in the air in a football game, in a pro football game, these runners are so fast, they can get down the field easily before the ball has come down. I don't know if you can appreciate that, but it's really amazing. So runners figured out, you know, the other team was like, hey, we got to stop these runners. These guys are getting in our way. And so they would have two guys that are there to stop the runner. Two guys at the line of scrimmage. Now, the whole thing with football is it's one-on-one matchups. If you have to do two-on-one, you're giving up something somewhere else. Well, these runners were so significant that the other team started putting two on each one runner. So you'd have your two runners, one on each side, and you'd have four players on the other team trying to stop those two. Well, some runners, you know, it's sort of an arms race, right? So then the runners figured out, hey, if I run out of bounds, you can't hit a guy out of bounds. That's a penalty, right? So I'll run out of bounds, and then I'll come back in and then carry on. So then the rules had to be sort of modified that if you go out of bounds, when you come back in bounds, you have to try and remember the definitions, but you have to do something before you can make a play. I think the definition is you have to do a football action, which could be blocking someone, or maybe it's not even that. Maybe I think someone else has to touch the ball before you can because you went out of bounds. Anyway, the advantage of going out of bounds and then the rules changing to handle that. Well, that's the same thing in golf. By hitting the ball over the corner, if you went to hit it over the corner and you were me, you know, accidentally hitting it over the corner and not hitting it very far, you would hit it out of bounds. So in a sense, Tiger was, in a sense, hitting it out of bounds and then back in bounds. He was sort of not cheating. It's not the right word, but the net effect was like a cheater in football. And so what they did was they had to change some of the golf courses. And the Masters was one of those places. Tiger, in his time, in his prime, he won the Masters 1 year by 12 shots. Now in golf, typical tournament, you might win by two shots, one shot, three, something like that. It's pretty typical. Sometimes tournaments finish and you're tied, and you have to have a playoff, a little mini playoff, just to decide who's going to win this tournament. To win by, let's say, five shots, unusual. Six, seven, rare. Eight, nine, almost never happens. 12, Tiger Woods. And he did it at the Masters. He did it at the greatest golf tournament there is. I just don't know what to say. It's just so amazing. Well, the guys at the Masters, I mean, this is a tournament with so much behind it, so much money behind it, so much thought behind it, so many great players behind it, that he kind of rattled. He rattled the cage. So they had to change the course. They had to do things so that you couldn't gain the advantage of shooting around the dog legs. And that's a reasonable thing to change. And so you put in stuff so that you lengthen part of that dog leg so that you can't possibly cut off the dog leg. But then, of course, the next level of golfers, the younger kids who grew up watching Tiger and are even stronger and even more, you know, powerful, and the clubs are even hitting it farther. Now they're hitting it 330, even 350 yards. Well, it used to be 330, 350. That was a par 4, meaning it took you 2 shots to get to the green. Often it would be in a straight line. And what they knew was, you know, most people hit at 250, so then your second shot would be 100 to 150, so you had to use a different club. Well, then these young, you know, whippersnappers came along with super special golf balls and golf clubs, and they could reach the green in one shot. Well, the way they deal with that is they introduce, you know, obstacles, whether that's large bunkers, you know, the fairway narrows, which means as you try and hit it farther, the safe area gets smaller, narrower and narrower, so that the risk goes up. So it's the old risk reward. So Tiger's been a big influence on the game in an area that, you know, the average guy watching doesn't really talk about or doesn't really notice. You know, you just take it for granted. But in changing golf courses and making them more interesting, when you watch golf, let's say you watch the seniors, they play on older courses. These guys don't hit it as far, so they can play on courses that the pros can't play on. They're too easy for the pros. These old courses, they got a lot of money invested in them. They want high-end players to play the courses because they make lots of money. So there's like a whole market, you could say, for the players that don't hit as far. And on the women's side of things, the women haven't, you know, got up to the same level as some of the men players in some ways. And so I notice that anyway around the green. The green on a woman's course tends to be sort of an easier thing to deal with than on the men's side. And, you know, it would depend on the tournament. As you get into the women's majors, the greens get tougher. Well, this is the ultimate end result. The ultimate end product is the Masters, where the course looks beautiful. It looks relatively simple. There's not a lot of bunkers. The holes aren't super extra long. But the greens, and where you have to hit the green to get that ball in the hole, is very small target zones. And so, just in a very nice way, they've made the game very challenging and really very complex, and yet with a backdrop of extreme beauty. The Masters is extremely beautiful. Easily the most beautiful golf course in the world. The level of attention that it gets is off the charts. To give you an idea, Rick Riley, who's a great sports writer, he did a little bit on some of the people who all but volunteer to care for the Augusta National Golf Course, the Masters course, for that once a year special tournament this week. And they do, you know, menial tasks, in some cases for no pay, but then they get some perks. And he wrote a whole article just about this. Reverent. This course is revered. One golfer yesterday said that in heaven, the golf course must be the Masters. Like, that's exactly what the golf course must be like. And, you know, maybe that sounds religious, but just trying to give you some idea of the level of this course. It's the Super Bowl of golf, definitely. And the Super Bowl moves from place to place. The Masters does not move. Some of the golf tournaments, they move. The lower-end tournaments tend to be at a given course for a number of years, so they don't move. At the next level, like the U.S. Open and the British Open, they move from course to course. They choose a course very carefully because they have to move to that place, so they've got to make sure that place can handle everything, the number of people and the difficulty that they want the course to have and all that. And then they craft the course, the height of the grass and everything. The U.S. Open is a created wonder. Each year, the Masters is a maintained wonder that it's always there, and it's just so elite. If you win at the Masters, you are invited back forever. Arnold Palmer, who won at the Masters 50 years ago, he played the Masters 50 years in a row. Imagine playing the greatest golf course on the face of the earth 50 years in a row. 50 years he was invited back When you've won, you go to the champions dinner. You have your own locker room in the clubhouse, your own little change area. They have your green, special green jacket with your name on it, your size, customized to you. Your jacket is in your locker. You become part of the furniture of the place. Arnold Palmer became part of the furniture for 50 years. Wow. You know, one time a year or two back, I was talking to the kids about quality in a vehicle. I think it was quality in, like, we were doing some art. We were, decorating plates and ceramic plates, and you throw some ceramic glaze on them, and then you cook the plate, and then you get your art, right? And, they were doing all these interesting patterns and everything, and my wife was doing one, so they, said to you, we'll do one for you. What do you want? And I said, just blue. Just put blue glaze on, nothing else. And they were like, they couldn't believe that. And after everything was all done and they were sort of looking at their artworks, I tried to talk about quality or luxury. What is it? What defines it? And this is something that people don't quite get. Some people don't quite get it anyway. Is that simplicity is luxury. You look in a car. The more expensive the car, the cleaner the lines and the sharper and more distinct the lines. It's sort of an interesting phenomenon because it's counterintuitive. You would think, the more you put into something, the more luxurious it is. Well, then you get cluttered if you're not careful. Then you get, where does your eye go? Where's the focus? So the beautiful thing at the Masters is the simplicity. You don't have to wonder where's the course, how to get there. You know where you're staying, and you know the road. You know when. If you've won once, you know you're going every year. Each course is named after a type of flower. They play beautiful music. They have less advertisements during the Masters than any other golf tournament. They just make a little comment once a day while pretty music is playing in the background, pretty piano music. They'll just say that, once again, our major sponsors are proud to bring you the Masters with limited commercial interruption, which translates to about 5 minutes of commercials per hour. In most shows these days, you get 20 minutes of commercials per hour. Not only that, but you get commercials in the show. You get product placement. You get little pop-up ads at the bottom of the screen. Coming up next, you get all kinds of gimmicks and annoyances. With the Masters, you get this melodic, light, uplifting piano music. Oh, for me personally, without a doubt, if I could only choose one golf thing to watch each year, it would be the Masters, without a doubt. Second would be the U.S. Open. And third would be, the British Open or the PGA. And there's also one, the fifth one is called the Players. And while those last ones are all good, the Masters, Butler Cabin, there's a famous story. I guess there's a card game that gets played on the grounds of the Masters somewhere each year. And it's by well-heeled patrons. When we say well-heeled, think B versus M, billionaires versus millionaires. They play cards, and the stakes, I don't know what they are exactly, but let's say it's like $1 a hand, $2, whatever it is. And one time, one of the newer players was complaining that they didn't seem to be playing for much money. Why don't we up the stakes kind of thing? And one of the other players just calmly said, okay, how much are you worth? And the guy stated his worth. Let's say it was $100 million. And the first person, the player who said how much you're worth, he said, I'll cut you for it. What he meant was, we'll take the deck of cards, I will make a cut in the deck, I'll grab some of the cards, and then you grab some of the cards, and whoever has the higher card when we turn them over gets all of your money. So let's say you're worth $100 million. So I'll cut you for it meant you're going all in with $100 million. You either are going to, in 30 seconds, you're going to end up with $200 million, or zero. So what that gentleman was saying was, the reason we don't play for large amounts of money is we have large amounts of money. And don't be so gauche. Don't be so nouveau riche. Don't be so crass in this revered environment. Play for a dollar a hand. It ain't about the money, sonny. That's one of my favorite stories of all time. I'll cut you for it. That's quiet confidence. The Masters is quietly confident that no matter who you are, when you go and play at that little golf tournament, that little golf course, you will be challenged. You will be humbled. You will bring your best game and a year worth of thinking about this course. And the course will go, I'll cut you for it. Oh, I hope some of you take in the Masters at some point in your life. Just soak it up. You know, there have been times when I've watched it, wire to wire as much as I could. This year, I've had a very different approach. The first day was Thursday, first play day. Wednesday is the par 3 contest. It's a friendly contest where the great players play with their children. Like 2-year-old, 5-year-old children, that kind of thing. And it's meant to be sort of a fun family day. Par 3s, 9 par 3s, and there's a winner, but you sort of don't want to win because it's considered bad luck. Anyway, during that whole thing, I had it on, I was doing a puzzle, and I almost never watched the golf. And I think the same was true on Thursday and Friday for the most part. And yesterday I worked, Saturday I worked, so I've watched hardly any of the golf this year. But what I have done is listen to probably a good 20 hours of analysis, 20 hours of commentary, 20 hours of the best minds in the business talking about this course. You got to wonder, how does something stand up year after year to the best minds putting in dozens of hours of commentary into the subject? How does it stand up? That in itself is a wonder. Some things don't stand up. You got to hand it to them. The Eiffel Tower stands up. The Eiffel Tower stays current, stays relevant, stays in our minds and whatnot all these years later because it did some great things and there's some great design behind it. Like one thing I heard recently, this is really cool. If you took a cylinder the size of the Eiffel Tower and you put it over the Eiffel Tower, think of it like a toilet roll going over the top of your rocket ship. If you have a little kid's toy rocket and you take a toilet roll tube, the cardboard tube, and you put it over the outside of your rocket. Well, what they figured out was if that cylinder goes over the Eiffel Tower, it's the same height as the Eiffel Tower and it's the same width as the widest part of the Eiffel Tower. They figured out that the air that cylinder would contain would weigh more than the metal Eiffel Tower. I thought that was an ingenious little calculation, an ingenious little bit of trivia to figure that out. So even though it's made out of steel, one of the most dense, heavy things there is, there's so little steel there. It's so airy. It's such an airy structure that it weighs less than the air of a similarly dimensioned object. It's a bit of a trick or a bit of a cheat because, the Eiffel Tower tapers, right? They didn't say if you put a pyramid over it, that the pyramid of air would weigh the same. They said a cylinder, so it's a bit of a cheat in that sense. But nonetheless, a good calculation and it gives you some perspective. Well, the Masters is a wonderfully refreshing week. ESPN has been advertising this tournament for at least 2 months, maybe 3 months. Imagine the leader in sports, ESPN, who cover all sports all the time. You can turn on the TV at any time, day or night, and you will be watching current sports coverage. Imagine advertising one golf tournament 3 months in advance. Oh, man. I guess it's a rarity. The Masters is a rarity. In this day and age, where we rush from one thing to the other, the Masters, they don't rush to the commercials, and they don't rush back. They don't rush around the course. They don't rush to talk about it. And so it's a wonderful part of life. So people wonder, how can women joke about being sports widows? And, if you are constantly off doing sports, that's excessive. But at the same time, there's nothing wrong with periodically appreciating an Eiffel Tower, periodically appreciating a great sporting event like the World Cup of Soccer this year, like the Olympics, Winter Olympics this year, like Wimbledon tennis, the World Series of baseball, or the Masters in golf, Pete's. So I have had the true privilege of enjoying some golf this week, and it's been delicious. I did want to say that, golf has become opinionated of late, and one very colorful fellow, David Faherty, who is a delightful Irishman, just so colorful, so delightful, so humorous, and so honest. He's now got his own TV show, and it's really first rate. But David Faherty is pure opinion, pure color. And golf has become colorful. It used to be that golf was, white shirts and shorts or slacks or whatever, kind of figuratively speaking. John Daly One of his sponsors is, I think they're called Loud Pants. Something like that. If I haven't got the name right, it's like that. That's his, one of his sponsors, and he wears the loudest, most shockingly colorful pants. So, it's interesting how golf, on the one end, the Masters personifying it, is very conservative. And very, it's almost like Mantovani or something. You know, it's almost like elevator music, or almost like a funeral home in a way. The quiet piano in the background as you reverently walk past the former great. But it's not a downer. Golf at the Masters is not a downer. It's just pure reverence. I'm trying to think at this moment of something else that we revere in the same way. And there's nothing I can think of that is like it. It's a unique experience. But there are very colorful people now in golf. You know, Leif Trevino was very colorful many decades ago, and so was Fuzzy Zeller. Payne Stewart, while he was alive, was known for his colorful outfits. NFL team-themed outfits. Ian Poulter is very colorful. Unusual, you know, spiky hair kind of thing. And there's some loudly colored players, but there's also some opinion players. Brandel Chambly, I guess he's a commentator on the Golf Channel. He can be really hard-hitting, really accurate, but really hard-hitting. And I think he crossed the line. He was basically accusing Tiger of cheating last year, like deliberately cheating. I'm not trying to misstate things. I'm not trying to make Brandel Chambly look bad. Hopefully I've characterized it accurately. But basically what he was saying was, you know, occasionally you make a mistake on a golf course and you get caught or you get penalized or you know. Typically, it's an honor system where the player themselves reports, hey, I think I hit the ball twice by accident in that rough grass. Well, four different times in 2013, Tiger did something that was a violation of the rules and didn't report it himself. Someone else noticed it and reported it. And so this got Brandel to the point of accusing Tiger, and he kind of crossed the line and kind of freaked out the network and had to apologize. But it didn't make him wrong. It just made him opinionated. Another great opinion guy is Johnny Miller. Johnny Miller is a color commentator, often on NBC. He was great. He won the U.S. Open with the low round of the U.S. Open ever, I believe. In the early days of golf, before Tiger, that is, players didn't dominate every weekend. In the era of Tiger at his best, if you wanted to predict who was going to win, in fact, they came up with a saying. They would ask it as a question. They would say, Tiger or the field, who do you have? In other words, 50-50. Tiger had a 50% chance of winning. The field had a 50% chance. And it was almost, at Tiger's peak, it was almost that one-sided. I think Tiger, in his best runs, was winning about a third of the tournaments he entered. Most, even the greatest players, might win, you know, a tenth of the tournaments they entered. So Johnny Miller was a dashing, great player, innovative player in his own way. Didn't win a lot, but has gone on to become an extraordinary color commentator. But he's full of opinion. He knows each player's weaknesses, and he'll say it. David Faraday likes that, and David Faraday's gone out of his way. It's an interview show, Faraday is, and he goes out of his way to get the most colorful, most unique people onto his show. So Miller was one of his early invitees. Well, the fourth person I wanted to talk about regarding opinion was the player that I picked to win this week's Masters. I picked them before the Masters started. I'm not usually very good at picking winners. I think I sort of get caught up in other people's analysis usually. Or I don't research it. I don't, you know, it's just a quick, I think, 30-second opinion. But this guy, the name just popped out and stood out. Jordan Spieth. S-P-I-E-T-H. Unusual last name. 20-year-old. Very young. If he wins, he'd be the youngest ever. Younger than Tiger. This Jordan Spieth is remarkable, and lo and behold, here we are going into the final day. He is tied for first. He's tied for the lead with another great, colorful, interesting guy, Bubba Watson. Bubba Watson's a young player. He won 2 years ago. Humble guy and just sort of a original guy, very powerful. I think he's left-handed. Has, you know, original shot-making. I don't know too much about Jordan Spieth. I just know that this is a guy that from an early age has wanted to win the Masters. He just, you know, he dedicated himself from, you know, the age of six or whatever. They set up a golf course on their property, their parents' property, and him and his brother, you know, played this course and talked smack with each other, and, you know, that's what he's wanted. It's being what he's dedicated to forever. And there he is. So I look forward to seeing how he does today. He advanced, or he held his own yesterday. he's on target. So I guess this has been a golf cast. I didn't think I could, anchor it entirely with golf. I thought I'd talk a bit about golf and try and select some of the reasons. Be selective. I'm just looking through some of my notes to see if I, covered everything I wanted to say about it. Golf is, a little underrated. Something like NASCAR, loud engines and colorful cars and big sponsors and guys being interviewed on TV. It's just something very colorful about NASCAR. Well, golf is more like Formula One. Formula One is true racing. NASCAR is a demolition derby. Formula One is the elite. The true elite cars. Pit stops in NASCAR take 20 seconds. I'm just going to make up a number. Let's say they're down to 12 seconds now. In Formula One, the pit stops are down to 2 seconds, which is to say you go in, they will change all your tires, and fill you up with fuel. In 1/1000, 2/1000, you're done. 2 seconds. It's almost unbelievable. You can't process it. Yes, they went in. Yes, they did everything and they left. But you can't believe it. You can't see the speed. If a fast runner was running by you, you could see the speed. But it's subtle. Formula One is subtle. Well, the Masters is subtle. It's beautifully subtle. There's one hole. I don't remember the hole number, but it's one of the holes. And you have to deliberately hit the ball past the hole. You have to. Everyone does now. Because the hole on that green is so steep that the hole is towards the bottom part that the ball will roll back. So if you just aimed at the hole, the ball would roll, 20, 30, 40 feet lower than the hole. And so you hit it 30 feet above the hole, and then it rolls to below the hole. I've never seen players having to account for roll that much before. You get players coming out of the woodwork with the Masters that you don't normally hear about, and there they are every year. Jimenez, one of the guys this year who's in contention, is 50. It's exactly 50. Well, in the golf world, that puts you on the Champions Tour. That puts you on the Old Folks Tour. This guy qualifies for the Old Folks Tour this year, and he's within a shot or two of the lead at the Masters on Sunday. The funny thing about this guy Jimenez is that his warm-up routine involves, you'd have to check it out on YouTube, Miguel Jimenez. Basically, he puts his hands on his knees, sort of squats a little bit, and then just sort of moves his knees around. And he does this while a very large cigar is held in his mouth, burning cigar is held in his mouth. So he's a throwback. But, oops, he's good. Don't count him out. Another great classic player, Freddie Couples. Similar age, vintage. Freddie has, had back injuries recently. Freddie was a guy I followed when both of us were much younger. Freddie was one of the young greats. Freddie is, I think for a lot of people, they don't fully understand Freddie. But he's a very quiet guy, understated guy, and very relaxed. And so you get this very relaxed golfer on the practice course, Freddie will just sort of talk mostly and occasionally hit a golf ball. And yet, he's in contention too. So there's a lot of reason to watch the Masters, and you don't want to waste your day, so I do all my usual chores and my usual activities, and I have the Masters on like the radio, with that lovely piano music in the background and limited commercial interruption. And it's one of my sports treats. Let's see what else is coming up. When I say coming up, that's different sporting events I'll be talking about in the future, probably to not quite the same extent as the Masters. I never knew I had that much in me about the Masters, but it's a wonderful tournament. Oh, how about if I do a bad driver of the week? I don't remember when this happened. This happened sometime in the last week or 10 days. But I guess collectively you'd have to say it was a bad driver of the month. I was driving downtown and just sort of going through the downtown on, high-speed highway, so sort of a bypass of the downtown, minding my own business. And suddenly, in a period of about 1 mile, there was about half a dozen bad drivers. And you get sometimes that's happened. You get sort of a pocket of bad drivers. Usually it's more driven by it's a full moon or it's, Friday night or Saturday night, sort of a bad time of the week where you get more of the more reckless drivers. Sometimes you just get a moment in time where you've just run into a pocket of more frantic than average drivers. It happens. If you're observant, you'll notice it. Well, the worst of this whole gang was a guy in a van. And it's a place where you can merge onto a different highway or you can stay on the one you're on, and similarly they can leave the one they're on or get onto yours. And the way it's done is through basically a very long two-lane turn lane. And so if you want to get onto the highway on your left, you have to cross a couple of lanes of often slow traffic to get into a very high-speed lane. Similarly, if they're coming off of that high-speed lane, they have to suddenly slow down and go into the slow speed. So that's always risky when you have great speed change and a large number of lanes and that you might need to change. Well, this guy was coming from the fast lanes, and suddenly at the very last second he went, "Hey, wait a minute, I need to turn off here." And he almost totaled his van. That van almost turned into a NASCAR crash. And he swerved off of the high speed, crossing solid lines and driving where you never normally drive. And he just made it into the lanes. I don't really almost know how he did it, especially a van is not a very, doesn't handle very well. It's not a very, I was going to say, you know, sort of aerodynamic, it's not the right word, but a van is not a nimble car because it's high-centered. The engine is a little higher than normal, and the weight of the van is higher than normal, and so it wants to tip over. He almost tipped over this van. For what? For nothing at all. He could have gone to the next exit and doubled back. It would have cost him 5 minutes. There was one other driver recently that, in that same area, a quarter of a mile earlier on a different day, someone realized they had to turn, and they proceeded to stop three lanes of traffic completely. In an intersection, me and one of the people stopped while they waited, and they were not a good driver. While they waited for people to let them in, I mean, sometimes you have to sort of, you know, assert yourself, gun the engine and jump in. And again, they could have just gone around the block. That's what made me think of it, was realizing that some of these bad driving things can be avoided just by going around the block. Oh, I need to turn there? Okay, I'll turn around the first chance I get. Which for this person, they could have gone. They could have kept going. All the lights are synchronized. They would have had one light, and they would have come back. You know, literally, it would have been 2 minutes. But no, they jeopardized dozens of vehicles, putting us in the middle of an intersection on a red light, forcing us to be trapped in an intersection. And there was just no regard for anybody else. They needed to turn. Anyway, that whole flock of bad drivers was kind of remarkable and unusual. And I sort of collectively give them the bad driver of the week. Each of them gets a nomination. And then the guy at the van was the bad driver of the month. And then that lady with the two lane changes, she was the runner-up. She would have probably got the bad driver of the month if it wasn't for the van guy who was going much faster and could have killed himself or somebody else. I could have seen a fatality there. It was that bad. So there's a little bit of bad driver of the week and month. There's a little piece on antibacterial soap, a little article. We've been going through a phase where we have alcohol wipes and alcohol stations and gels, and we're all worried about germs. This is a total myth. This is a total lie in our face. It's a total scam. We are germ creatures. We are filled with germs. We have hundreds of different germs, different bacteria. There was a Wired magazine, Wired.com, did an article on the germs in the human body, and they did it in a graphic. They showed by colored zones, they showed the human body, and they showed the hundreds of different species that live in the different parts of our body. In other words, we need these things. We have a community of bacteria that live on us, and it has evolved. There's a pecking order, and there's a natural necessity. It's like bees. It's like honeybees, right? Something like 80 or 85% of plants need honeybees. 80 or 85% of the foods that we eat would not be there or would be different without honeybees. Well, we need bacteria. This little article was saying if you used antibacterial soap, it actually promoted Staphylococcus aureus, and that people who used this antibacterial soap tested positive for this Staphylococcus aureus. In other words, it made things worse. Well, why is that? It's like antibiotics. Antibiotics do the same thing. Antibiotics kill it all, right? People go to the doctor for common colds, and the doctor gives them antibiotics. Antibiotics are overprescribed. Antibiotics kill everything. And then your body has to rebuild everything. That's bad. Not to mention people, antibiotics are supposed to be on there for like 10 days so that you thoroughly kill everything for sure, and then you rebuild. Well, people will go on for 2 or 3 days. They'll feel better after 2 or 3 days, and then they'll go off. Well, then you haven't killed everything, and then stuff can build up immunity. And this is where the immunity problem comes up with antibiotics. So, in other words, this antibacterial soap, it's another case where drugs are bad. We all use drugs, so many drugs. People have laundry lists of drugs. Just looking through my notes, there was one this last week. Sweden is going to try out a 6-hour workday. you know, in America they work 8 hours, and I'm from Canada where you average 7 to 7.5 hours. And in some countries like Sweden here, they were going from a 7-hour day to a 6-hour day. How is that possible? The answer is things are more cooperative there. People are working together. And people are not wrecking it for themselves and everybody else. America is a bit more dog-eat-dog. Went to a sales conference by a paint manufacturer. And at the conference, they had a placemat. And it was like an inspirational placemat, because this is a conference for a get-together for, you know, all the salesmen in Canada. It was, you know, pretty big paint company, well-known quality paint company. And on this placemat, it said, the saying they had chosen for this conference, it said, run, but don't weaken, because there are many more that can take your place. There's some inspiration for you. That's some inspiration, North American style. Run, but don't weaken, because we can replace you. That's what slaves do, right? Slaves had to run and work themselves to the bone because, well, just to keep alive, right? We have a bit of a slave mentality in North America. Well, Sweden doesn't. They're trying out a 6-hour workday. In a related point on that article page, it said that Germans work, trying to work it out, they work 1,400 hours a year. In America, we work 2,200. Germans are working like a 6-hour day already, it sounds like. But they produce 70% more than the Greeks, who work, you know, more like Americans, so 2,000 hours. So it's interesting how there wasn't really a direct connection between productivity and how many hours you work. And that's the thing. Sweden gets that. Germany gets that. It's not about how many hours you work. It's how well you work. For myself, I'll work all day long, but I have pockets where I am more productive, and pockets where I'm less productive. And that's how it's meant to be. Try and get that naturalness going in your life, where you're aware of yourself and you know your high and low points, and you allow them. And you don't just, you know, have another shot of coffee to get you through that moment. Maybe you have a nap, if you have the ability to have a nap, or you go at a lesser pace for a period of time. Do a simpler task while your body goes through a low energy phase and recovers, and then you can get back to your, you know, high speed. There's a number of physics articles I'll save for next week. Humorously stupid physics articles. You know, physics is like, it's really like religion, which is so ironic. You know, religion comes up with the same game every weekend, right? Every Sunday, right? They got the same message, the same lie, right? It's the same thing they state as fact that no one knows, no one can prove. Physics is like that. It's got these crazy, wonky theories that don't stand up to any kind of scrutiny, and they just trot out these stories. Yeah, there's no proof for this crazy, wonky theory. You know, there's been a bunch of those lately. Anyway, I'm going to talk about skateboarding in the future. And I want to talk about, at some point, I want to talk about my homemade birthday cake plate. I'll just leave it at that. I want to talk about my desk, the desk that I work at. There's some stories from my railway days that are kind of fun stories to talk about those. So I just want to give you something of an inkling of what's coming up. Taking a little perspective break this week and just truly delving deeper into the world of golf. There used to be a show called The Wonderful World of Golf. You know, golf used to be boring. Believe it or not, back in that Wonderful World of Golf era, golf was kind of boring. Tiger started to shake things up. And the response to Tiger, like at the Masters, has made golf a vastly better game. Before Tiger, people, you know, might make $1 million in a season. After Tiger, now you make well over $1 million on just an average run-of-the-mill tournament. And winning at the Masters now, in terms of your lifetime, is probably like winning $10 million. You get invited back, guaranteed, to a tournament where, you know, you can quickly get in the money, right? If you get into the weekend, you're in the money, general rule. But the sponsorships and the interviews and the attention you get, it's the top of the heap, the Masters, and I'm going to thoroughly enjoy it today. I don't have to work today, and I'm ready to watch it. After 3 or 4 days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, of listening to it, Saturday, of missing it almost altogether. Sunday is going to be my day of rest and my day of enjoyment of the greatest golf tournament on earth. So hopefully I haven't bored you, despite talking about sports primarily. Hopefully I haven't bored you. Hopefully there's been something there to chew on. You know, these Floydcasts are designed to put your mind on a different plane while you're driving. That's sort of my target audience, target market, is the person driving to work. I've found that driving can be frustrating. it's, of course, can be dangerous. And I think that's where the frustration stems from, is that you're all trying to do something that slightly conflicts with others. You know, he wants to go here, you want to go there. You know, it has to be cooperative, but sometimes people aren't. It has to be done safely, but sometimes it isn't. It has to be done in a timely fashion, but sometimes it isn't. And it's expensive. Cars are expensive. When we commute, we have to use our car in some cases. You know, the distance that we travel, or the time of day that we travel, or, you know, the bus service doesn't come out to where we live. We're trapped. And if you can put your mind in a different place while you commute, it's a much better experience. And so anyway, that's a major part of the benefit of this kind of a cast, is that it helps you to put your mind somewhere else. I put a lot into these floodcasts, at least 10 hours a week for one floodcast of about an hour. So hopefully you enjoy them. So this has been Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing this floodcast number 9 for Monday, April 14th, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.